B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. Happy Halloween. It's Thursday, October 31st, 2019. After our power outages, well, we were in the darkness. Somehow trick-or-treat doesn't have the same appeal here in California this year. I am happy to report that the fire in Sonoma County, the Kincade Fire, is now getting more and more under control. All but about 30,000 people have been permitted to return to their homes. And so here in Northern California, we are in some ways returning to normal. Southern California is being pummeled by Santa Ana winds, and there are fires in the region. I don't have a full detail for you here, but there are four or five significant fires in the Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles area. Yesterday is when I was able to break my silence. They turned the power back on here in Northern California. And while I mostly just kind of rambled about my own experience during the time when the power was out, I led with the very concerning news that journalist Max Blumenthal, who is the founder of the Gray Zone Project and a man who I have deep respect for as an author and as a reporter, he was arrested last Friday in Washington, D.C., and even 24 hours after I shared the story with you, the corporate media is blacking out the story. It is stunning. I did a Google search here just before I sat down, and I used simple terms. Max Blumenthal arrested. And you come up with the usual independent outlets, Democracy Now!, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, World Socialist Website, Truth Dig, Gray Zone, his own outlet. Also, Consortium News wrote up the story, and Sputnik International. Now, because Sputnik is a Russian media, state media outlet, this will, of course, allow people to say, look, it was covered by Sputnik. That shows that he's on the wrong side of things. The post-millennial I haven't heard of before, RT, that's Russia Today, another one of those Ruski media outlets that the corporate media can use to explain away its own failure to report an important story about a working journalist in this country. So I turn to page 2 of the search results. We have Sputnik UK, Sputnik International, Citizen Truth, More Democracy Now!, Radio Utopia, the Peter B. Collins podcast, Commentary Magazine, which refers to him as useful idiot. I haven't read the full story. Oh, that was written in August, so that's not about the arrest itself. Let's take a risk here. Go to page 3. Aaron Maté did a piece on his pushback video. That's on the Gray Zone, too. But in the first 3 pages, not a single corporate media outlet shows up. Not even the Washington Examiner or one of the so-called weekly alternative papers. So, and of course, corporate media, in terms of television, doesn't consider Max Blumenthal to exist. Now, I also think that his reporting on Venezuela, on Syria, has led corporate media outlets to say, well, you know, he's not really singing from the right hymnal here. He's not one of us. So I recommend the coverage by Kevin Gostola over at Shadowproof. By the way, I've linked to that story and many others in the show file for today's podcast. And Gostola recaps the story of how Ben Rubenstein, who is the brother of Mint Press journalist Alex Rubenstein, who was inside the Venezuelan embassy when Code Pink and others were occupying it on behalf of the Maduro government. This was back in April and May of this year. And Ben Rubenstein went to the embassy to try to deliver some food. He encountered a supporter of Juan Guaido, that is the rogue element in Ukraine that has been acknowledged by our government despite its lack of any constitutional basis. And the report is that a woman named Pacheco, she is Nailet Pacheco, a 58-year-old opposition supporter, told police she was guarding the rear gate when individuals who brought food and water in approached her, and then she says they attacked her. Now, in one account, they say that she was kicked in the stomach by both Rubenstein and Blumenthal, and the Washington Post published a story on May 9th that quoted Pacheco with a different story, saying that she was pushed against a wall and kicked by several men. Now, Rubenstein says the opposition members made up these lies about Max, and I know they're lying. They're obviously using the government and police as tools to get revenge. Now, his case, he was charged with so-called assault back on May 9th, and it's still pending in D.C. Superior Court. So those are the fundamental facts here. There is coverage of the Max Blumenthal story in the English-language Latin American outlet called the Orinoco Tribune, and Caitlin Johnstone has weighed in with a powerful piece on her Medium page today. She says that Blumenthal is charged with simple assault alleged to have taken place 5 months ago during that notorious standoff when the U.S. government was working to remove the official Venezuelan government from its Washington embassy and replace it with diplomats from the Guaido-led puppet government. Johnstone says, I watched the news of the embassy standoff with much interest, largely because the obnoxious, oafish behavior of the anti-Maduro counter-protesters on the scene were a perfect reflection of the obnoxious, oafish behavior I've experienced from anti-Maduro accounts online. But I've never run into such an intellectually dishonest, crude, nasty group of people in my years on this job as those who've been cheering on the Trump administration's regime change agenda in Venezuela. There's no doubt in my mind that someone from this unscrupulous, shady group would, kind of turn the page here, be capable of making false allegations against a dissident journalist who disagreed with them. She posts Blumenthal's tweet, I was arrested on Friday in a completely false charge manufactured by the Venezuelan opposition related to their siege of the embassy in D.C. I spent 2 days in jail, was shackled for extended periods, and denied my right to call a lawyer. And then he links to the Gray Zone report that was published of that incident. So then Johnstone quotes a tweet from Mark Ames. He and Yasha Levine worked on a newspaper called Exile in Moscow in the 1990s. Ames tweeted, arrest and caging of opposition U.S. journalist Max Blumenthal reminds me and others I know of the worst of Russia. Except there, when Oppo journalist Ivan Gulenov was arrested, most big-name Russian journalists, including Putin-friendly, publicly supported Gulenov. Here, silence. Johnstone notes this is because this is the same media class for years has been either mute or vocally favorable on the persecution of another dissident journalist, Julian Assange. And then she quotes, I think the guy's name was Niebuhr. I don't have it in front of me. She doesn't name him. But it was the German pastor who wrote that refrain that people have heard many times. First they came for the socialists and I didn't speak. Well, Johnstone has rewritten it. First they came for Assange and I did not speak out because I was a mainstream Western journalist with no intention of ever upsetting the powerful. Then they came for Blumenthal, and I did not speak out because I was a mainstream Western journalist with no intention of ever upsetting the powerful. Then they came for all the other dissident journalists, and I did not speak out because I will never be a dissident journalist. They never came for me because I have chosen to serve power. In its continuing yellow journalism coverage of Latin America and Venezuela in particular, over at the Washington Post today, they're stoking speculation based on no facts. And in fact, the speculation gets contradicted as you get deeper into the article. But it asks the question, is Nicolas Maduro behind the unrest in Chile and in Ecuador? And there is no public evidence to indicate this. Simply the whining of people like the new guy in Ecuador, Lenin Moreno, who wants to blame somebody else for his problems. But listen to this. As the streets of South America convulse in the region's worst bout of social unrest in years, a chorus of critics on the right are decrying what they see as one inescapable link, the nefarious hand of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Now, the tone of this is a little light, and it's like the article doesn't take a position. They just observe these nutcases on one side, and then they say, well, gosh, you know, it could be a little bit of both here. So they quote Michael Shifter of the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue. I think what's happening is mainly the product of national circumstances. That doesn't mean there's no outside agitation. But to put the blame outside is to miss the point that there are fundamental domestic problems that can account for all this unrest. But that doesn't stop them. That's on page 2 of my printout, and this story runs a total of 8 pages. Next, they say senior officials from Ecuador, Chile, Argentina, and elsewhere are pointing the finger at Maduro for the outbreak of severe street protests. And President Trump denounced unspecified foreign efforts in his sympathetic call to Chilean billionaire President Sebastian Piñera. Now, there's no discussion of the Chicago School of Economics, of disaster capitalism, Naomi Klein's great work on this. No, they don't talk about the big picture. They look for ways to point fingers. And Maduro is the easy target. Here's a paragraph about him. Maduro, who's dealt with bouts of serious unrest of his own this year, has vacillated between appearing to claim credit for the multiple uprisings and poking fun at his enemies' accusations. At one point, he described the regional turmoil as part of a plan hatched at a meeting of Latin America's far left in Caracas in July. But he's also joked that they think they can that I move my mustache and bring governments down. I'm thinking, which is the next government I want to overthrow? So there's a guy with a sense of humor, but they want to find dark, dark implications of what he's saying. So this is just more of the same. And they keep on publishing it. And then they wonder why the media gets labeled as fake news by Trump, and a lot of people buy into that. So today on Capitol Hill, an historic moment, as a party line vote was conducted in the House to approve the rules for impeachment and the process going forward. And there were 2 Democrats who voted against it. They are, by the way, if you're keeping score, Colin Peterson of Minnesota, Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, 1 Republican, a former Republican, Justin Amash, who now calls himself an independent. He voted with the Democrats, but all Republicans, 194 of those jokers, voted against impeachment. And this sets the stage for a highly partisan effort where process will be attacked at every stage by the Republicans. And this process was one of their big complaints, right? Pelosi's conducting this in secret, using the Benghazi rules that were crafted by John Boehner and used by Trey Gowdy. And now that she's held this vote, they'll move on to other claims that it's illegitimate and a witch hunt and all that stuff. And as you know, I am still skeptical of using Ukraine and the Ukraine Gate story, even as it is blossoming in some ways, as the central or sole focus of this. So minutes after the vote, the White House press secretary said this is a sham impeachment, a blatantly partisan attempt to destroy the president. The resolution outlines the rights and procedures that will guide the process, including how Trump and his legal team will be able to mount a defense. And the vote removed almost any doubt that Democrats will bring a full-fledged impeachment case against Trump. They now talk about the timing. They think that they can get articles written during the month of November and try to hold the House impeachment vote before Christmas. That would push the trial in the Senate into January. That does sideline the senators who are running for president. And it will be certainly a distraction of sorts. And the New York Times makes an interesting note that when Bill Clinton was impeached, 31 members of the Democratic Party voted in favor of the process. That is, very similar to the vote that took place today. And not a single Republican defected in today's vote. Just for balance, I am including in the show file a link to Peter Van Buren's latest post at the American Conservative. And lately, I've been scratching my head. Peter's banned from Twitter, so he's very active on Facebook, and I see a lot of his posts. And I think he has gotten sole ownership of the perch that I would call anti-Trump. And Van Buren puts up a lot of commentary undermining or criticizing the Democratic moves, and some of it is well-deserved. He also asserts that he is not a Trump supporter, but that he sees the Russiagate narrative as purely partisan and the latest Ukraine gate as something very similar. In his piece today, he says Pelosi is blowing smoke, but where's the fire? And he talks about the latest testimony that I'll detail for you in a moment. But he says, forget that CIA whistleblower. He had no firsthand knowledge of a high crime or misdemeanor, just an opinion about a phone call that he wasn't party to. Well, I share Peter's suspicion about the whole CIA whistleblower channel. And I've been honest about that since it first surfaced. And Eric Swalwell, who is a media ho and was on TV again last night, a failed presidential candidate who's holding on to his House seat from here in the Bay Area, Swalwell was saying, we don't even need the whistleblower. He was just like the guy who pulled the fire alarm. Now, I think that that is a little far-fetched. Now, at the same time, as we'll note here in a moment, the Republicans are eager to expose this whistleblower. And even though I'm dubious about how a member of the CIA advances a criticism that's not related to fraud or abuse or waste or those sorts of things, it's an odd duck in a strange mode there, trying to fashion this as a whistleblower event. Anyway, back to Van Buren, he says, to impeach, one must conclude that Trump, and he cites the memo of the phone call to Zelensky that was released. He says, one must conclude that Trump asking for information, however far-fetched, on possible foreign interference in 2016 was wrong. Trump asking for an investigation into whether Biden used his office for personal gain is of no interest to the people of the United States, even if that same information were also of interest to Trump. I'm not sure about that, Peter. To dig up dirt on Trump and allowing that a Ukrainian investigation could supposedly exonerate Biden. So I don't think Peter has real strong arguments here. But I do believe he has a point of view that is worth examining as we dive into this impeachment process. And a lot of people will just listen to Rachel Maddow and not have a critical view of what's going on. She is cheerleading the impeachment process with nary a negative thought permitted to appear. So that's Van Buren's piece. Last Friday, Judge Beryl A. Howell, sitting on the Federal District Court in Washington, gave a big boost to the impeachment process, saying that they are legally engaged in an impeachment inquiry and that they are entitled to receive the grand jury testimony that was delivered to Robert Mueller's investigation. Now, I don't know that there's anything in there, although I'd love to see if there's actual evidence that, you know, Russia hacked the DNC and gave that stuff to WikiLeaks. And we'll reprise that coming up in a moment, too. But I do think that this is a substantive ruling that shows that the Democrats are not simply on a fishing expedition. So today's investigation interviews before the House committees featured Tim Morrison, who announced his resignation yesterday from the White House National Security Council, where he was recruited by John Bolton to be the top Russia and Europe advisor. Now, this guy is he's quite a hawk, and he thinks quite similarly to John Bolton. But he did say that Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador to Ukraine, told the truth and that he had two conversations with Taylor. In one, he alerted Taylor to a push by Trump and his deputies to withhold security aid and the White House visit for Zelensky until Ukraine had agreed to investigate the Bidens. Although he said he did not necessarily view the president's demands as improper or illegal, simply problematic for U.S. foreign policy in support of Ukraine. So Morrison, according to people familiar with his testimony, said that the call on July 25th and then conversation he had with the ambassador in September, that Morrison alerted the NSC lawyers about a separate conversation between Trump and Gordon Sondland, according to Taylor's testimony to Congress. So there's just a little bit coming from Morrison. Yesterday was the testimony from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who was the top expert on Ukraine at the NSC. And he said that the memorandum of the phone call, as I have suspected since the day Trump released it, is not complete, and that there were elements that were edited or omitted from this call record. Now, because the original release document said it was not a verbatim transcript, I think they will slide out of any responsibility for misleading the public or Congress using this document. But I strongly suspect that this was the Bill Barr filter, the same way he handled the initial summary of the Mueller report to spin it up in a way that was helpful to Trump. So Vindman said that the elements that were edited out of the call, including Zelensky specifically referring to Burisma Holdings, the company where Hunter Biden was on the board of directors, and so at minimum, the House committees must demand to get a verbatim transcript of the entire call with Zelensky. I think at minimum, that's just fundamental investigation and evidence gathering. Now to the issue of this alleged CIA whistleblower. I was listening to Rush Limbaugh a little bit on the way into the secret studio today, and he had he dropped a name that I had never heard before, and implied that that is the name of the CIA whistleblower. Now the Republicans used the Vindland testimony yesterday to try to get him to cough up the name of the whistleblower, and it appears that Vindland may have been in contact with that whistleblower. But Adam Schiff and the Democrats on the committee shut that down, and so to date, the whistleblower remains unknown to the public and clearly to the Republican agitators. Now, the other day, over 70 inspectors general across governmental departments wrote a letter criticizing the Justice Department for its decision under Bill Barr back in September not to refer this CIA whistleblower letter or report to Congress. Quote, whistleblowers play an essential public service in coming forward with such information, and they should never suffer reprisal or even the threat of reprisal for doing so. Now, of course, we have to note that there are two kinds of whistleblowers, and this guy from the CIA is an approved government leaker and whistleblower. But Julian Assange isn't. Chelsea Manning wasn't. Reality Winner isn't. And I think you know the rest of the people on that list. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And let's just name one name today. Dolores Evans checked in, and she first heard me on the mic in Madison, Wisconsin, back in the day. And she says she found the podcast a couple of years later. And she now writes from Tucson, and I don't know if she's retired there or if she's just a person with more than one home. And Dolores doubled her renewal money because she said one of her sons has started to listen to the podcast. Well, I'm delighted that you're evangelizing, Dolores. It's great to hear from you from Tucson or Madison or wherever you make your crib. And if you'd like to join the ranks here, I invite you to become a subscriber, too. Visit peterbcollins.com. You click on Menu, then you click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, where in seconds you can choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you're allergic to PayPal, I understand, you can communicate using the U.S. mail. My address is Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, zip code 94915. Well, I am pleased to report that Twitter announced the other day that they are banning all political advertising from the platform, effective next month. Now, I think this is a wise move. Rather than try to censor ads or flag the ones that they believe are untruthful or misleading or just downright scurrilous, Twitter is saying it's not worth the trouble. And I'd like to see Facebook do the same thing. Because Mark Zuckerberg in his charm tour, the charm offensive in Washington last week, really made no effort to distinguish between comments that you and I post that are covered by our First Amendment rights, which are not fully in effect on a private platform like Facebook. But those comments are private and personal. That's free speech. When somebody buys an ad on Facebook and uses all of the targeting information to decide who gets to see it and who doesn't, and then they manipulate the truth or just outright lie in that ad, well, I think Facebook would be good to follow Twitter. But I know that Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg are heavily competitive, and I don't expect that to happen soon. Dorsey tweaked Zuck in this tweet. It's not credible for us to say we're working hard to stop people from gaming our systems to spread misleading info, but if someone pays us to target and force people to see their political ad, well, they can say whatever they want. Now, Jack, you can claim moral high ground, but Trump continues to sully your platform and shit all over it every day, and you don't do a thing to stop it. So I'll accept and commend your decision to stop taking political ads. But don't claim that you're some great free speech defender. John Brennan was at the National Press Club in Washington yesterday, flanked by other former spooks, and he widened his comments about Russian meddling in the 2016 election. He said he was sure, personally, that those Russian efforts changed the mind of at least one voter. Just one. And then he said whether it was one voter or a million voters, I don't know. Now, this is the guy who wrote the assessment that claimed that Russia hacked the DNC and gave it to WikiLeaks, and there's never been any evidence for that. And this is such a wild claim. Is this one of these vaunted John Brennan assessments? Does he have high confidence in the range of one voter to 1 million voters? No. He continues to promote the same bullshit that he has been promoting as Russiagate for over 3 years now. And one of my listeners got in touch with me last weekend and said, Peter, John Brennan is appearing before my graduate school class. Do you have a question for him? And so I fed this person a question, and here's what I wrote. Mr. Brennan, the Mueller report says that Russian intelligence hacked the DNC servers and gave the emails to WikiLeaks. Mueller referenced the intelligence assessments in the report issued in January 2017. Can you tell us if there is any evidence, and will the public ever see it? Well, my correspondent did get to ask the question and wrote, he seemed a bit agitated at the question and said he couldn't talk about some of the information in the Mueller report, and some of it may come out in the future. He said, that being said, he had no doubt that the jump went from Russians to WikiLeaks. Well, you may have no doubt, Mr. Brennan, but you got to prove it. And the kinds of games that our intelligence officers have played with us over the years, openly deceiving the American public, and your buddy James Clapper got caught in perjury live on C-SPAN. And yet, you expect us to believe your evidence-free claims over and over again, even as you expand them with no additional evidence. Now, we're not all Rachel Maddow sycophants. And because we challenge the intelligence community doesn't mean we support Trump. And that's where the state of play is today. Well, the Democratic tongues are wagging because Tulsi Gabbard announced the other day that she is going to stay in the presidential race and pass up the chance to hold on to her House seat from Hawaii. And in the second paragraph, the New York Times has to insert its opinion The spin? It's likely to fuel speculation that Ms. Gabbard may be preparing for a third-party race for the White House, a prospect that has unnerved Democrats. Last week, Hillary Clinton suggested that Republicans were grooming her for such a bid. Now, I take Tulsi at her word. She has said she's not going to run third party. I've heard nothing of what the Green Party has planned. And any other attempt to run third party is suicide. You can't get on the ballot in New York State and many others. And so I remain skeptical that Tulsi Gabbard has these ulterior motives. I continue to welcome her voice in the campaign, in the debates. It's an uneven voice, and I don't agree with her on every issue. But her fundamental opposition to regime change wars is really valuable as we see the Democrats become more and more the neocon pro-war party in the bizarre climate of today's politics. Well, today, Katie Hill will be remembered as a congresswoman who didn't even complete one term. She voted to impeach Trump, and then she gave a final speech to Congress, saying that she is leaving because of a double standard and the misogynist culture that gleefully consumed my naked pictures, capitalized on my sexuality, and enabled my abusive ex to continue that abuse, this time with the entire country watching. Last Friday, I reported to you about the photos, and it appears her ex-husband was responsible for leaking them, and they show her, I guess, in bed with a female. She's openly bisexual, so I don't find that shocking. And frankly, I'm disappointed that she has resigned. I know that Pelosi pressured her to do so, and I think that's wrong. They haven't learned a damn thing from forcing Al Franken to the exits. And Katie Hill is right. A man who brags about his sexual predation, who has had dozens of women come forward to accuse him of sexual assault, who pushes policies that are uniquely harmful to women, and who has filled the courts with judges who proudly rule to deprive women of the fundamental right to control their own bodies, sits in the highest office in the land. Now, to add insult to this injury, George Papadopoulos says he may run in the special election to choose a successor to Katie Hill. I never imagined we would sink to these levels, friends. Following Trump's great moment of announcing the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and gilding the lily with his own characterizations that, he was killed like a dog or something like that. Trump loves that kind of language. Oh, I'll get to that in a moment. Anyway, they have announced that after the number two was killed in an airstrike, separate from the raid on al-Baghdadi's little bunker in Idlib, that they have picked a new successor. The Islamic State announced that the new leader is Ibrahim al-Hashemi al-Qurashi, Q-U-R-A-Y-S-H-I, and that last appendage is an indication that he's being portrayed as a descendant of the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad, which gives, some sort of special value to his lineage. So then the Islamic State issued this statement. Do not be happy, O America, for the death of al-Baghdadi. Do not forget the cups of death at his hands. May God accept him. Do you not realize, O America, that the Islamic State today stands at the threshold of Europe and Central Africa? It is expanding and remaining with permission from God from the east to the west. And then they describe Trump as a stupid old man who goes to sleep with one opinion and wakes up with another. Now to a report from Dan Cohen at the Gray Zone Project on how the U.S. created a safe haven for Baghdadi and the Islamic State in Idlib. And it was by providing support to al-Qaeda. And this, of course, is bizarre to most Americans who have very little knowledge of what's really been going on in Syria. And here's where I pick up the commentary on Trump announcing that Baghdadi died like a dog, he died like a coward. And this is the kind of talk that is tawdry, it's tabloid, and it's TV lingo. You know, you could imagine that in a screenplay on one of these dramas based on national security, like, Homeland or one of those programs. So the article goes on to praise Tulsi Gabbard, one of the few people to state the inconvenient truth about Idlib, as she referenced in the most recent Democratic debate, drawing a nasty response from Kamala Harris. And fact checkers found that Gabbard's statement was false, but Dan Cohen here says that actually she's been telling the truth about this. So I think it's a worthwhile read. Check it out. The link is in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. I'm still puzzled by Trump's claim that the U.S. is going to take the oil from northeast Syria. I've heard his refrain that to the winner goes the spoils, but how do we get to declare ourselves the winners? And how do you expect, with a couple of hundred American troops, to be able to secure the oil fields in northeast Syria when Russia and Syria come calling? And maybe even Turkey's going to weigh in from the other side of the border there. So I find this totally bizarre, but it's a meme that is continuing. Also, Caitlin Johnstone has a second noteworthy report that's over at Consortium News today, following up on her coverage last week of the whistleblower from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. This goes back to the 2018 chemical attack asserted in Douma, Syria, and we now have a second whistleblower who claims that contrary findings were suppressed. And this is based on reporting from a British journalist named Jonathan Steele. And this is an important, I think, break in the way the corporate media has simply asserted that Assad used chemical weapons. And we've looked deeply into the Douma episode, and the canisters of chlorine gas did not appear to have been dropped from the sky. But that is the impression that was created, and it led to a U.S. assault in Syria. And who needs proof when you're not looking for it? A couple of quickies here on the way out. Microsoft is the winner in the $10 billion Pentagon cloud contract. Now, I don't have a favorite here. We know that Google was in the running, Microsoft, and Amazon. But I do believe it deserves investigation to find out if Donald Trump interfered in this contract bidding to make sure that Jeff Bezos and Amazon didn't get it. And had they gotten it, I'd be complaining about that. So, and finally today, just to illustrate the incompetence of the people who are being selected to pack our federal courts by Trump and his minions at the Federalist Society. Yesterday was a new low point when Lawrence Van Dyke was appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee and they read into the record the brutal comments from the American Bar Association that have found him not qualified to serve on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in my San Francisco. Lawrence Van Dyke is described as arrogant, lazy, an ideologue, lacking in knowledge of the day-to-day practice. After 60 interviews with lawyers, judges, and others who work for him, they also say he has a lack of humility, an entitlement temperament, a closed mind, and an inconsistent commitment to being candid. Now, none of that seemed to bother him as much as a claim that he would be unfair to members of the LGBTQ community. For 15 seconds, he couldn't speak. He was holding back tears. He finally did start to cry, and in a shaky voice, he said, "I did not say that." Now, over 150 young, mostly white, almost entirely male nominees have been confirmed to the federal, district, and appeals courts since Trump took office. And with idiots like this, who will serve as long as they want, it's a lifetime appointment. They could be there for as long as 40 years. Thanks for listening to my Ranting and Raving, my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.